This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Hyperfocus, How to Be More Productive in a World of Distraction. This is the author, Chris Bailey. For Arden. Chapter 0. Why Focus Matters. Attention is everywhere. I'm writing these words over the sounds of clanging cutlery and muffled conversations at a small diner in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. I've always been a fan of people watching. There's so much to take in. How they dress, walk, converse, and act when they're either around or not around others. At a busy cafe or at a diner like this, it's fun to see personalities collide like particles in an accelerator. To observe a guy's personality change when he switches from talking to his friend to chatting up the waitress. To watch the personalities of waitstaff shift when serving each table, adapting to large families, young couples. In focusing on other people, I've made a lot of observations about what those other people are focusing on. In any given moment, we're all focusing on something, even if we're just lost in our internal thoughts. Let's take a glance through the diner. I turn my attention first to the two 20-something girls at the table to my left, who are mostly focusing on their smartphones instead of each other. Between bouts of texting, they flip their phones face down on the table. This, it seems, is a pretty pointless gesture. They've picked them back up 30 seconds later. While I can't make out their every word, I can tell they're skimming the surface on the conversation they could be having. They're with each other in person, but their attention is elsewhere. Or take the couple across the room. They're engrossed in a conversation fueled by hot coffee and buttermilk pancakes. They were engaged in relatively quiet small talk when they arrived, but their conversation soon became more animated. Unlike the girls, this couple is focused only on each other since sitting down. A catchy Ed Sheeran song comes on over the restaurant's speakers, and my attention is drawn to the two guys sitting a few tables over from the couple. One of them subtly taps his foot to the beat while his friend orders. The foot tapper is presumably spreading his attention across three things: the song, what his friend is ordering, and his own breakfast decision. After he orders the three egg express, when the server asks how he'd like his eggs prepared, he directs his attention inward, seemingly recalling how he usually takes them. He orders scrambled. At the bar are a few strangers making idle conversation while watching last night's football highlights. I find it especially fascinating that millions of people around the world, including these three guys, are fixated on an 11-inch piece of tanned cowhide. As I watch, one of the guys cocks his head lost in thought. Then, as though a shockwave was traveling through his body, he rushes to capture an idea in his pocketed notepad. While he was lost in a daydream and to the tune of football highlights, an insight struck him from out of the blue. He had a eureka moment. Or take me, sitting here with my laptop. This morning, as I sip coffee and nibble home fries, I've been able to focus more deeply on my work and have more energy to burn. My morning meditation may have helped. I find I'm able to write more words when I take part in this ritual, 40% more by my calculations. I left my phone at home so I could write distraction-free, and so my mind could rest on the walk to the diner and wander. As I'll discuss later, disconnecting is one of the most powerful ways to spark new and innovative ideas. The music playing on the restaurant speakers is catchy, but not enough to be distracting. I'm not here for the soundtrack, though, and also chose this diner over my favorite cafe because there's no Wi-Fi. Constant connectivity is one of the worst disruptions to our focus and productivity. As this story demonstrates, I'm a bit distracted by the environment and the people it's hosting, but they're serving as good fodder for this introduction. This restaurant scene is a handy illustration of a revelation I had a while back. Attention is all around us. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. Everyone awake on the planet, in this one moment, whether they're eating breakfast, working, or spending time with their family, is focused on something. Attention is the backdrop against which we live our lives, wherever we go and whatever we do, even if we're just noticing the thoughts in our head. It has been a few years since I first began to explore how we can not only focus better, but also think more clearly. While this is tough to admit, especially as someone who was making his living as a quote-unquote productivity expert, I started to notice my own increased distraction, especially as I accumulated more devices. I had never been so busy while accomplishing so little. I had grown restless with boredom and a lack of stimulation and was trying to cram as much into every moment as I could. I knew that my brain never functioned well when I was trying to multitask, but I felt compelled to do it anyway. Working with my email client open and my smartphone on my desk was simply more appealing than trying to concentrate on one or two simple things. For me, this book was born out of necessity. I wrote it because I needed it. When I get excited by a new idea, I typically order dozens of books on it and nerd out about that topic. Focus has been my most recent fascination. This includes how we can best manage the distractions around us, multitask more effectively, if that's possible, it is, battle our resistance to focusing on tasks that make us procrastinate, and also better unfocus so that we can genuinely relax and recharge. In my reading, I found an awful lot of information, advice, often contradictory, that was fun to read, but ultimately didn't help me progress my work and life forward. I then turned to actual scientific research, scores of academic studies and decades of documentation dedicated to learning how we best focus. As a footnote, reading a research paper from front to back is way easier said than done, but pretty doable when you're interested in the topic. Curiously, research shows that what lets us focus when reading isn't the complexity of a paper or article, it's how interested we are in what we're reading. As I carefully read every study I could find, the focus folder on my computer became massive. I amassed tens of thousands of words of notes and began to identify the most practical, tactical lessons from them. I started speaking to the world's foremost attention researchers to get to the bottom of why we get distracted so easily and discover how we can get our stubborn minds to focus in a world of distraction. And I started to experiment with the research myself to see if it was actually possible to get a grip on my focus. What I discovered completely changed not only how I work, but also how I live my life. I began to see focus as not only a contributor to my productivity, but also a factor in my overall well-being. Surprisingly, I learned that one of the best practices for fostering my creativity and productivity was learning how to unfocus by paying attention to nothing in particular and letting my mind wander. As I did on my way to the Kingston Diner, I found that I became better at making connections between ideas and coming up with new ones. I also found that we discover more distraction today than we have in the entire history of humanity. Studies show we can work for an average of just 40 seconds in front of a computer before we're either distracted or interrupted. Needless to say, we do our best work when we attend to a task for a lot longer than 40 seconds. I went from viewing multitasking as a stimulating work hack to regarding it as a trap of continuous interruptions. While trying to do more tasks simultaneously, we prevent ourselves from finishing any one task of significance. And I began to discover that by focusing deeply on just one important thing at a time, hyperfocusing, we become the most productive version of ourselves. Above all else, I began to view attention as the most important ingredient we can add if we're to become more productive, creative, and happy at work and at home. When we invest our limited attention intelligently and deliberately, we focus more deeply and think more clearly. This is an essential skill in today's world, when we are so often in distracting environments and doing brain-heavy knowledge work. This audiobook takes you on a guided tour through my exploration of the subject of focus. I'll share not only the fascinating things I've learned, but also how to actually put those ideas to use in your own life. I've road-tested all of them. Productivity research is great, but pretty useless when you don't act upon it. In this way, I see Hyperfocus as a sort of science help audiobook, one that explores the fascinating research behind how you focus, but also bridges those insights with your daily life to explore ways you can manage your attention better to become more productive and creative. These ideas have changed one life, mine, and I know they can do the same for you too. On the surface, the results can seem a bit like magic, but magic stops being magic the moment you know how it's done. Chapter 0.5, How to Better Focus on This Book. Listening to this book is your first chance to put your focus to the test, and the more attention you can dedicate to it, the more you'll get out of the time spent on it. Let's begin on a practical note with 7 ways to focus more deeply while listening. But first, a quick comment. If I've learned one thing from my research, it's that productivity is highly personal. Everyone is uniquely wired and has different routines. As a result, not all productivity tactics will mesh comfortably with your life. Not to mention the fact that you may simply not want to follow some of the advice I offer. Experiment with as many of these focus tactics as you can and adopt whatever works for you. 1. Put your phone out of sight. When your mind is even slightly resisting a task, it will look for more novel things to focus on. Our smartphones are a great example. They provide an endless stream of bite-sized, delicious information for our brains to consume. As I'll discuss later, distractions and interruptions are infinitely easier to deal with before they become a temptation. Start seeing your smartphone for what it really is, a productivity black hole that sits in your pocket. To focus on this book, I recommend leaving your device in another room or turning on airplane mode if you're using it to listen to this book. It may take your brain a few minutes to adjust to not having your phone or pad attached at your hip, but trust me, it's worth powering through that initial resistance. It's never healthy to be dependent on something, addictive, shiny, rectangular devices included. Side note, here's a fun experiment to dive deeper into this idea. Over the span of a day or two, pay attention to the number of times you instinctively pull out your phone. How are you feeling, and what compels you to reach for it? Are you trying to distract yourself during a long elevator ride? Are you avoiding a boring task like updating your quarterly budget? By noting the times you habitually reach for your phone, you'll gain insight into which tasks you resist the most and how you're feeling in those moments. 2. Mind your environment. Look up and around you. Where are you listening to this audiobook? How likely are you to be distracted or interrupted as you listen, and is there a place you can go to avoid those distractions? Or are you listening in an environment where you don't have much control, such as on the train or the subway? Modifying your environment is one of the top ways to cultivate your focus. The most focus-conducive environments are those in which you're interrupted and distracted the least. If possible, move yourself to one of those places, whether it's a cafe down the street, the library, or a quieter room in the house. 3. Make a distractions list. Distractions will always be present, even if you manage to find a listening spot in a Japanese Zen garden with your phone far away. External distractions aren't the only ones to blame. Think of the distractions that come up internally, like your brain reminding you that you need to pick up groceries. Whenever I have to focus, I adopt the two tactics I've just talked about, and I also bring a pen and a notepad with me. In the notepad, I write every distraction that makes its way into my mind, things I need to follow up on, tasks I can't forget, new ideas, and so on. Maintaining a distractions list as you listen will capture the important things that float to the surface of your consciousness. Writing them down to make sure they don't slip through the cracks will let you refocus on the task at hand. 4. Question whether this book is worth consuming at all. We consume a lot of things out of habit without questioning their worth, books included. Take time to weigh the value of your routine consumption. A tactic I find helpful is to view the descriptions of books, TV shows, podcasts, and everything else as pitches for your time and attention. Ask yourself, after consuming one of those products, will you be happy with how you invested your time and attention? Just as you are what you eat, you are what you pay attention to. Attention is finite and is the most valuable ingredient you have to live a good life. So make sure everything you consume is worthy of it. As I'll cover in depth later, bringing awareness to what you consume can provide hours of extra time each day. 5. Consume some caffeine before listening. If it's not too late in the day, caffeine takes 8 to 14 hours to metabolize out of your system, consider listening alongside a cup of coffee or tea. Caffeine provides an invaluable focus boost, and while you usually have to pay this energy back later in the day as the drug metabolizes out of your system, the costs are often worth it. Caffeine boosts your mental and physical performance in virtually every measurable way. Use this energy boost wisely to focus on an important task or to listen to this book. 6. Grab a pen. There are two ways to consume information, passively and actively. One of my many habits that bother my fiancé is that I tear out the first page of every book I read to use as a bookmark. She argues this is sacrilegious. I say there are more copies of the same book at the store. This is only the start of the carnage. I also read with a highlighter and a pen in hand so I can mark up the book as I read it. The number of highlights and notes on its pages indicates how much I liked it. When I finish that first read, I go through the book a second time, rereading just the highlighted parts so I can really process the most valuable nuggets. If I can, I'll annoy someone nearby by sharing these bits so I can process them again and even more deeply. I hope that while listening to Hyperfocus, you'll make notes on the ideas that work best for you, pulling the best ideas out of this audiobook and carrying them in your mind to build and act upon later. 7. When you notice your focus wavering, your ability to focus isn't limitless. While you can improve your attention span, it's only a matter of time until it begins to waver. This often takes the form of your mind wandering away from the words on the page to the thoughts in your head. This is perfectly normal and human, and as we'll see later, this wandering can be remarkably powerful when harnessed. For now, though, when you do notice your focus fading, step back from this book for a few minutes to do something relatively mindless. Whether it's washing the dishes, people watching, or cleaning the house, you'll effectively recharge your attention. Once your focus has been reset, return to the audiobook with a fresh mind. And just as you've kept a distractions list while you listen, make sure you have a place to capture ideas that come to mind during your break. Part 1. Hyperfocus. Chapter 1. Switching off autopilot mode. Autopilot mode. Right now, there's a good chance that you're focused on this audiobook. But how did you get here? Looking at the books in my own library, I've learned about most of them through recommendations from friends, podcast appearances by the author, or having loved a similar book. Most of us don't deliberately plot out which element of our lives we want to improve before settling on an audiobook that will help us address that issue. We often arrive at those reading decisions because of a confluence of events. Take, for example, the last book I read. One day, I was riding in a taxi, whose driver had the radio on, and I heard an interview with the author. Later, a friend tweeted about that book twice. This accumulation of mentions led to my eventual decision to buy the book. The process as a whole was anything but deliberate. Our not plotting out in detail everything we do and every decision we make is, for the most part, a good thing. I made the series of decisions involved in purchasing many of my books in autopilot mode. Autopilot mode enables us to keep up with the demands of our life. For example, imagine if every email response required you to draft your answer in a new Word document. From there, you'd have to reread it several times, send it to your significant other for improvements, and print it once or twice to do line edits, only to arrive several hours later at a final, eloquent, "Sure, sounds good." This might be a productive thing to do for an important project, but for every email? Imagine being just as deliberate buying ketchup, taking out the trash, or brushing your teeth. Autopilot mode guides us through actions like these. As many as 40% of our actions are habits, which shouldn't require conscious deliberation. Unless you're a monk who has the luxury of being able to meditate all day, it's impossible to live intentionally 100% of the time. But some decisions are worth making more deliberately. How we manage our attention is one of them. We typically manage our attention on autopilot. When we receive an email from our boss, we instinctively stop what we're doing to respond to it. When someone has posted a picture of us online, we check to see how we look, then click to read what the poster said about us. When we're talking with a coworker or a loved one, we automatically focus on forming clever responses in our head before she finishes her thought. One of the most underrated skills? Letting other people finish their sentences before starting yours. Here's a simple exercise that'll take you 30 seconds. Come up with an honest answer to this question. Throughout the day, how frequently do you choose what to focus on? In other words, roughly, how much of your time do you spend deliberately and with intention, deciding in advance what you want to do and when you'll do it? Most people don't fare too well with their answers. We lead busy lives, and at most, we only occasionally choose to focus on something intentionally. When we catch ourselves daydreaming, sense that we've been procrastinating, fall into the trap of bouncing around the same several apps or websites, or realize we've zoned out while watching our kids. After we snap out of autopilot mode, we consider what we really ought to be doing and make the effort to realign our neurons to focus on that instead. While falling into autopilot mode can help us keep up with the pace of work and life, attention is our most limited and constrained resource. The more we can manage our attention with intention, the more focused, productive, and creative we become. A day in autopilot mode. The environments in which we live and work, unfortunately, have their own agenda for claiming our attention, bombarding us with alerts, notifications, beeps, and buzzes. This steady stream of interruptions prevents us from diving into any one thing properly. After all, it isn't long before we're presented with another email that feels just as urgent. If you're still here, you're probably better at focusing than the average person. Listening to an audiobook requires a good deal of attention. And with attention becoming a rare commodity, fewer people are able to devote themselves to listening without distraction. But it's worth quickly asking, how much of your attention are you directing to what I'm saying in this moment? Are you focused on it 100%? 85%? 50%? How has your level of focus changed over time, especially as you moved from one environment to another? How frequently has your mind wandered from what I'm saying to the thoughts in your head, eyes skimming focus-free, until you caught yourself and tuned back in? Even the most experienced, focused readers have these mind-wandering episodes. As a footnote, curiously, research shows that our eyes actually scan the page more slowly when our mind is wandering. Our eyes and our mind are tightly coupled. Becoming aware of when your scanning begins to slow will help you halt these mind-wandering episodes with greater ease. Future developments in technology could lead to tablets and e-readers that catch our mind-wandering episodes before we do. It's not unusual to have a hard time focusing. There are countless everyday examples of how little control we have over our attention in our daily lives. Take, for example, the following. How our mind refuses to shut off when we're laying in bed at night. While a large part of us wants to sleep because we have things to do in the morning, our mind insists on reliving the entire day. How our mind brings up cringeworthy memories at the worst possible times. Where do these thoughts come from? How incredible ideas and insights come to us while our mind is wandering in the shower, but the same insights don't strike when we need them the most. How we find ourselves having forgotten our reason for entering the kitchen or bedroom. Why did we lose our grip on our original intention? How we can't focus on something when we want to, like writing a report that's not on a deadline. Or why we procrastinate and focus on things that aren't productive instead of spending our time productively. How we find ourselves in bed bouncing around between a loop of the same 5 smartphone apps, checking for updates again and again until we snap out of our trance. We may fall into a similar mindless loop on the internet, switching between news websites, IM conversations, and social media. How we're unable to stop worrying about certain things until they're resolved or vanish into the ether. As you listen to hyperfocus and learn to focus more deliberately, these lapses will make a lot more sense, and you'll even learn how to prevent them. The 4 types of tasks. In many ways, managing your attention is like choosing what to watch on Netflix. When you first launch the website, you're presented with a landing page highlighting just a few of the many shows that are available. The Netflix homepage is like a fork in the road, only instead of 2 paths forward, there are thousands. Taking some of those paths will leave you feeling happy, some will mindlessly entertain you, and others will teach you something useful. Deciding where to direct our attention presents a similar fork in the road, only the pathways lead to the innumerable things on which we can choose to focus. Right now, you're absorbed in this audiobook. But if you look around you, you'll see many alternative objects of attention. Some are more meaningful and productive than others. Focusing on this audiobook is probably more productive than focusing on your smartphone, the wall, or the music in the background. If you're grabbing breakfast with a friend, focusing on him or her is infinitely more rewarding than watching the football highlights playing in the background. When you tally up all of the potential things on which you could focus in your external environment, there is truly an overwhelming number of options. And that's not even counting the trivia, ideas, and memories in your own head. This is the problem with managing your attention on autopilot mode. The most urgent and stimulating things in your environment are rarely the most significant. This is why switching off autopilot mode is so critical. Directing your attention toward the most important object of your choosing, and then sustaining that attention, is the most consequential decision we will make throughout the day. We are what we pay attention to. To make sense of all the things bidding for our focus, it's helpful to divide our tasks into categories. I'll discuss focus here largely as it pertains to work, But these ideas apply just as much to your life at home, as several sections later in the audiobook will explore. There are two main criteria to consider when categorizing what to focus on. Whether a task is productive, you accomplish a lot by doing it, and whether a task is attractive, fun to do, or unattractive, boring, frustrating, difficult, etc. Imagine a 2x2 grid that divides up the four types of tasks in our work. On the top, tasks are split up as either unattractive or attractive. On the left of this grid, tasks are split up as either productive or unproductive. Anything productive and unattractive is necessary work. Anything productive and attractive is purposeful work. Anything unproductive and unattractive is unnecessary work. And anything attractive and unproductive is distracting work. I'll refer to this grid quite often, so let's quickly take a look at each of the four categories of tasks. Necessary work includes tasks that are unattractive yet productive. Team meetings and calls about your quarterly budget fall into this quadrant. We usually have to push ourselves to do this type of work. Unnecessary work includes the tasks that are both unproductive and unattractive, like rearranging the papers on your desk or the files on your computer. We usually don't bother with these tasks unless we're procrastinating on doing something else or resisting a task that falls into the necessary work or purposeful work categories. Spending time on unnecessary work tasks keeps us busy, but such busyness is just an active form of laziness when it doesn't lead to actually accomplishing anything. Distracting work includes stimulating, unproductive tasks, and as such is a black hole for productivity. It includes social media, most IM conversations, news websites, water cooler chats, and every other form of low-return distraction. These activities can be fun, but should generally be indulged in small doses. The better you become at managing your attention, the less time you'll spend in this quadrant. The remaining category is purposeful work, the productivity sweet spot. These are the tasks we're put on earth to do, the tasks we're most engaged in as we do them, the tasks with which we make the largest impact. Very few tasks fit into this category. Most people I've encountered have 3 or 4 at most. Doing good work in this category usually requires more brain power, and we are often better at these types of tasks than other people are. An actor's most purposeful tasks might be to rehearse and perform. A financial advisor's purposeful tasks might be to make investments, meet with clients, and educate herself on industry trends. A researcher's most important tasks might include designing and running studies, teaching, and applying for funding. My most important tasks are writing books and blog articles, reading research to encounter new ideas, and giving talks. In your personal life, your purposeful tasks might include spending time with your kids, working on a side hustle, or volunteering with a local charity. A perfectly productive person would focus on only work that's productive. If things were that simple, though, you wouldn't need this audiobook. As you've no doubt noticed, sticking within the borders of necessary and purposeful work is much easier said than done. Every day, tasks from all four quadrants compete for our attention. Working on autopilot means we are more prone to falling prey to the unnecessary and distracting ones, and often spend time on necessary and purposeful work only when we're on deadline. I noticed something interesting as I applied the research in this book to my own life. As time passed, I began to spend less time on autopilot and focused more attention on my most purposeful and necessary tasks. As you become more deliberate about managing your attention, I think you'll find the same to be true for your work. Side note, here's an immediate way to improve your productivity. Divide up your work tasks based on the four categories into this same grid. This simple activity will give you an incredible awareness for what's actually important in your work. Because I'll return to the grid often going forward, divvying up your work activities based on whether they're productive and attractive will be valuable as you make your way through the audiobook. There's a printable chart you can use to do this on the website for this audiobook at hyperfocusbook.com. Chapter 2, The Limits of Your Attention. Without selective interest, experience is utter chaos. William James. Your focus determines your reality. Qui-Gon Jinn, Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. The Boundaries of Your Attention. Our attention is the most powerful tool we have to live a good life and get stuff done. But our ability to focus is constrained in two main ways. First, there's a finite limit to how many things we can focus on. That limit is smaller than you might think. If we could actually focus on more tasks simultaneously, we'd be able to do far more in the moment, memorizing someone's phone number while playing the piano, carrying on a conversation with two people and responding to an email on our phone. Realistically, we can, at most, do one or two of these things well at the same time. Our environment sends a steady stream of information to our brain every second. Think about the sights, sounds, and other information coming at you in this moment, and you'll realize there is a nearly infinite number of items at which you could direct your focus. Timothy Wilson, a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, estimates that our brain receives 11 million bits of information in the form of sensory experiences each second. But how many of these 11 million bits can our minds consciously process and focus on at once? Just 40 of them. Not 40 million or 40,000, but 40. When we choose what to focus on, we're effectively sipping from a fire hose. One conversation, for example, consumes the majority of our attentional bits, which is why we can't carry on two at once. According to renowned psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, simply decoding a conversation so we can understand it consumes more than half of our attention. As well as interpreting a person's words, you have to parse the meaning behind what he or she is saying. When you're conversing, there are countless other places to direct your remaining attentional bits. Your work tasks for tomorrow, random thoughts in your head, the lamp behind your partner, the timbre of her voice, or what you're going to say next. But extracting the meaning of what you're hearing is the best use of your focus. The second way that our attention is limited is that after focusing on something, we can hold only a small amount of information in our short-term memory. The ability to temporarily store information in our minds is practically a superpower, and it's what enables us to think about what we're doing as we're doing it, whether that involves problem-solving tasks, for example, carrying over digits when doing arithmetic, or planning for the future, example, plotting the best sequence of exercises at the gym. Without this temporary mental scratch pad, we'd be mindlessly reacting to whatever was happening in the world around us. When it comes to holding information in our temporary memory, though, the magic number of which our brain is capable shrinks from 40 to 4. Try to memorize the following list of names and then write them down. Arden, Rick, Ryan, Lucinda, Louise, Martin, Kelsey, Sineza, Dwight, Bryce. When asked to remember the names they remember, some people are able to recall only 3, while others can manage 5, 6, or even 7. The average number, though, is 4. In this context, the number 4 refers to the unique chunks of information. For example, If you can find a way to connect a few of the names into such chunks, such as visualizing a few friends who have the same names as the ones on the list, you'll be able to process them more deeply and remember more. In my case, I can remember all 10 names and still have room to spare. I'm not some super genius, though. To create the list, I picked the names of the 10 people I emailed the most this week, which enabled me to effortlessly group them together for memory's sake. We can use this concept of chunking things together to better remember any number of practical things throughout the day. This morning, I was listening to an audiobook while getting groceries, a difficult combination to do simultaneously. I needed to buy 3 things, celery, hummus, and crackers. When I walked into the store, I visualized a triangle with the location of each of the 3 items as one of its points. Instead of struggling to remember my grocery list independently, I was able to walk the triangle. Visualizing a meal consisting of the same 3 ingredients would have done the trick too and is probably an even simpler idea. Our lives are generally structured around the fact that we're able to hold at most 7 pieces of unique information in our short-term memory. You need look no further than the world around you to see evidence of how we organize data into mentally orderly units. Start with the number 2. There are countless examples in pop culture that show the power of the pair. We can easily hold 2 things in memory at once, so it's no accident that combinations of 2 are found everywhere, from dynamic duos like Batman and Robin to Bert and Ernie to Calvin and Hobbes. The number 3 also fits comfortably in our attentional space. We award 3 Olympic medals and grow up with stories like Goldilocks and the 3 Bears, the 3 Blind Mice, and the 3 Little Pigs. The list goes on. We divide these stories into 3 parts, the beginning, the middle, and the end, and have sayings like good things come in threes, celebrities die in threes, and third time's the charm. We also group ideas into 4s, the 4 seasons, 5, the 5 love languages, 6s, the 6 sides of a die, and 7s, days of the week, deadly sins, and wonders of the world. Even most phone numbers fit comfortably within this attentional limit. One set of 3 numbers, or maybe 4 if you're in the United Kingdom, followed by another 4 digits, making the full number easy to hold in your mind as you dial. You have to dig deep to find common examples of groups larger than 7. Meet your attentional space. Attentional space is the term I use to describe the amount of mental capacity we have available to focus on and process things in the moment. Our attentional space is what we're aware of at any given time. It's the scratch pad or clipboard in our brain that we use to temporarily store information as it's being processed. Attentional space allows us to hold, manipulate, and connect information simultaneously and on the fly. When we choose what to pay attention to, that information occupies our short-term memory, and our attentional space ensures it's kept active so we can continue to work with it. Together, our focus and attentional space are responsible for most of our conscious experiences. If your brain were a computer, your attentional space would be its RAM. Technically speaking, researchers refer to this space as our working memory, and the size of this space as our working memory capacity. We'll discuss attentional space in considerable depth in hyperfocus. Given that this space is so small and can hold only a few things at once, it's essential we manage it well. Even when we're daydreaming and focusing on nothing in particular, we fill our attentional space. When we focus on a conversation we're having, that conversation claims our complete attentional space, at least when it's interesting. Streaming a video while cooking dinner crams both these tasks into our attentional space. When we retrieve a memory or fact, like a friend's birthday or the name of the song from our long-term memory, this information is temporarily loaded into our attentional space for when we need it. This space holds everything that you're aware of. It's your entire conscious world. I find reading and the science that studies how it fills attentional space a particularly fascinating subject. If you're truly paying attention to what I'm saying, You have almost no attentional space remaining for other tasks. Just as you don't have sufficient attentional space to both text and drive, you can't text while you read. Either of these two tasks alone requires too much focus to fit comfortably in your attentional space. At best, you might be able to drink a cup of coffee while reading, but there's a chance it could get cold if you become too immersed in the text, or you might spill some on the book when you try and fail to do both. As you read, your brain is hard at work, converting the raw bits of perceptual information into facts, stories, and lessons that you remember and internalize. After your eyes register the waves of light emanating from the page, your mind generates words from them. These words temporarily fill your attentional space. You then begin connecting the words to form syntactic units and clauses, the fundamental building blocks of sentences. Finally, using your attentional space as a scratch pad, your brain groups those combinations of words together into complete ideas so you can extract their higher level meaning. Sentence structure can influence this process and slow down or speed up how quickly you read. Much as the world doesn't combine many groups of data into sets larger than 7, every book is structured to accommodate a reader's restricted attentional space. Sentences have a limited length and are punctuated by commas, semicolons, and dashes. According to one study, the period at the end of a sentence is the point when our attentional space, quote, stops being loaded, and what has been present in it up to that moment must be in some way stored in a summarized form in a short-term memory. Your attention is constantly synced to what you're reading or doing. Here's an interesting example. You even blink in accordance with where your attention is directed. You normally blink 15 to 20 times a minute, but do so during natural breaks in your attention, such as at the end of a sentence when reading, at pauses in an audiobook, or at breakpoints when watching a video. This blinking rhythm happens automatically. All you have to do is pay attention to what you're reading, and your brain's attentional space takes care of the rest. What's filling your attentional space? Let's do a quick check-in. What's occupying your attentional space at this moment? In other words, what's on your mind? Are this audiobook and your thoughts about it consuming 100% of your attentional space? If so, you'll process it faster and better. Are you devoting a third of your attention to thinking about the smartphone by your side? Is part of your mind planning what you'll do after completing this chapter, or distracted by something you're worried about? Are these concerns or anxieties popping up out of nowhere? Directing your mental gaze to what is currently occupying your attentional space can be an odd exercise, as we rarely notice what has taken hold of our attention, but spend most of our time totally immersed in what we're experiencing. There's a term for this process, meta-awareness. Becoming aware of what you're thinking about is one of the best practices for managing your attention. The more you notice what's occupying your attentional space, the faster you can get back on track when your mind begins to wander, which it does a remarkable 47% of the time. Whether you're writing an email, taking part in a conference call, watching a TV show, or having dinner with your family, you're essentially spending half of your time and attention on what's not in front of you, lost in the past or calculating the future. That's a lot of time and attention to waste. While there is immense value in letting your mind scatter, most times we do better to focus on the present. Side note, this is essentially what mindfulness is, noticing what your mind is full of, what you're thinking, feeling, and perceiving at any given moment. Mindfulness adds another important dimension to the mix, not judging what you're thinking about. When you become aware of what is occupying your mind, you realize it can come up with some pretty crazy stuff, not all of which is true, like the negative self-talk that sometimes takes root in your head. Everyone's mind does this on some level, so you shouldn't sweat it too much or take all of your thoughts too seriously. As one of my favorite writers, David Kane, puts it, quote, "All thoughts want to be taken seriously, but few warrant it," end quote. Simply noticing what is occupying our attentional space has been shown to make us more productive. One study asked participants to read a detective novel and try to solve the crime. It compared readers whose minds wandered without awareness to those whose minds wandered consciously. Solve rates were substantially higher for the group that was aware that their minds had wandered. We perform significantly better on every task when we're aware that our mind is wandering. If you pay attention to what's on your mind, which is admittedly hard to do for more than a minute or so, you'll notice that the content of your attentional space is constantly changing. You'll understand that it truly is a scratch pad, with thoughts, tasks, conversations, projects, daydreams, conference calls, and other objects of attention continually passing through. You'll also find that your attentional space expands and shrinks depending on your mood. Objects of attention fade from this space just as quickly as they came, usually without your awareness. For all the power it provides, the content of your attentional space is ephemeral. Its memory lasts for an average of just 10 seconds. Tasks that pair well. So what exactly can fit comfortably within attentional space? Tasks take different amounts of attentional space depending on their complexity. A meaningful conversation, as opposed to a casual one, fills up most, if not all of it. That conversation will suffer as a result of trying to cram too many other things into your attentional space. When you leave your phone on the table during a conversation, for example, you're bound to be distracted by the possibility of incoming messages. Not all tasks require this much attentional space. There are two types of tasks in our life and work. Habits, which we can perform without much thought and require minimal attentional space. And complex tasks, which can be done well only with dedicated focus. Many experts argue that we can't multitask, which is often true for tasks that require focus to do properly and thus occupy a larger amount of attentional space. But the same is not true for habits. In fact, we're able to multitask surprisingly well with habits. Though we may not be able to carry on two conversations simultaneously, we can walk, breathe, and chew bubblegum while we listen to an audiobook, the last task being the one that will easily occupy what's left of our attention. Habitual tasks like cutting your nails, doing the laundry, archiving emails you've already read, and grocery shopping don't require nearly as much attention as more complex tasks. This makes it possible to multitask without compromising the quality of your actions. Every Sunday, I like to lump my personal, relatively rote maintenance tasks together. Tasks that help me maintain who I am, like preparing meals, trimming my nails, and cleaning the house, and do them all in an allotted period of time while listening to podcasts or an audiobook. It's easily one of my favorite weekly rituals. You can do the same, for example, on your daily commute. If you listen to an audiobook during that routine hour-long trip, you'll be able to read an extra book each week by utilizing the attention freed by a habitual task. Habits take up very little attentional space because they take little thought once we get going with them. As cognitive neuroscientist Stanislas Dehaene, author of Consciousness in the Brain, told me, quote, "If you think of habits, such as playing the piano, dressing, shaving, or driving on a familiar route, these are so automatic that they do not seem to prevent any conscious thought," end quote. He says that while habits like these may require some level of conscious initiation, once we begin the behavior, the rest of the process takes care of itself. We may need to make conscious decisions occasionally, such as when we're getting dressed and our usual Tuesday outfit is in the wash, but after that intervention, we can switch back to the rest of the habit sequence without much thought. Dehaene believes that this process is, quote, "presumably driven by sequence-related activity," end quote, in the brain. The brain even assists when we try to do more than one habitual thing simultaneously. By rerouting blood flow away from the prefrontal cortex, the brain's logic center, to the basal ganglia, which helps us run through the habitual sequences of daily routines. Our attentional space can process even more when we're working on unrelated tasks. Take sorting and putting away the laundry while talking on the phone, for example. These activities tap into several senses, sorting laundry into our motor and visual senses, the phone call into our auditory sense. Because we use different brain regions to process them, the tasks aren't competing for the same mental resources. There is a tipping point to attentional space, of course. Doing too many habitual things at the same time will cause your attentional space to become overloaded. This is especially true if what you're doing isn't totally automatic and requires frequent mental intervention. Ultimately, the point is this. The number of habitual tasks we can fit into our attentional space is much higher than the number of demanding ones. Tasks that we can't do out of habit, such as reading a book, having a deep conversation, or preparing a progress report for our boss, consume significantly more attentional space, because doing them well demands that we consciously manipulate information on the fly. If we tried carrying on a conversation with our significant other out of habit, we'd probably not process or remember it and find ourselves falling back on statements like, "Yes, dear." If you divided your work tasks into the four categories I described in Chapter 1, an activity I highly recommend because I'll be referencing it later, you'll notice that your most necessary and purposeful tasks can't be done out of habit. If you can do your most productive tasks out of habit, it's a sign you should probably delegate them to someone else, eliminate them entirely, or make a conscious effort to spend less time and attention on them. This is exactly what makes these tasks so productive. You accomplish more in doing them because they require focus and brain power and take advantage of unique skill sets. Anyone can do mindless work out of habit. This is one of the many reasons why distracting tasks are so costly. While these tasks are attractive and stimulating, think watching Netflix after a long day at the office instead of grabbing dinner with a friend, they steal precious time from your most productive work. Spending time on our most productive tasks means we usually have very little attention to spare, if there's any left at all. Unlike habitual tasks, we aren't able to fit two complex activities into our attentional space at the same time. Remember, we can only focus on 40 bits of information, and a single complex task requires most of these bits. And on top of this limit, we can process only so much at one time. Since even moderately complex tasks consume most of our attention, we're at best able to pair something habitual with a more complex task. There is no easy way to predict how much attentional space a task will consume. For example, driving will demand much less if you're an expert than if you're a driver's ed student. You're better able to chunk together information on the fly when you have experience with a given task, which provides more freedom to focus on other things. Another variable is the actual size of your attentional space, a measure that's different for everyone. In summary, there are generally three combinations of tasks that fit comfortably within your attentional space. 1. A few small habitual tasks. We're able to breathe while we run, pay attention to our heart rate, and enjoy music all at the same time. As mentioned earlier, initiating these habits requires attention, and then another attention boost if we need to intervene to stay on track or if we're listening to music to change the track. 2. A task that requires most of our focus, as well as a habitual task. Our attentional space is powerful, but it's also very limited. At best, we can do one small habitual task plus one other activity that requires most of our attention. Two examples, listening to a podcast or audiobook while doing maintenance tasks, or playing a simple, repetitive game on a phone while listening to an audiobook. Filling the rest of your attentional space with habitual, mindless tasks is often not the best way to use spare attention. So when possible, avoid loading it to the brim. 3. One complex task. Your most productive tasks, the ones that enable you to accomplish significantly more for every minute you dedicate to them, fall into this category. The more time and attention you spend on these tasks,